Hi, hello. My name is Anastasia A. Aliftin. I use pronouns they, them. I have short, light brown hair. I'm white. Today, I'm somewhat sickly pale. I wear light grey jeans and black t-shirt. There are thick black lines of floral tattoos showing from under the sleeves. I'm a theorist and an artist. I read and write, and sometimes I perform what I write. And I'm honored to be a resident and your core field worker, dear Living Methodologies, generously organized by BioArt Society and held by Yvonne, Elisa and Mila. And I'm honored to welcome you for 3 cooling off and regrounding reading sessions in Kilpisjärvi in Sápmi. We will meet there very soon, but before we do, I'd like to leave in your pocket the first tape. There are overall 5 tapes, gently supporting our arrival, our departure, and our studying together. Studying in ways Fred Morton frames it. To study. A commitment to the idea that study is what you do with other people. It's talking and walking around with other people, working, dancing, suffering. Some irreducible convergence of all of that, held under the name of speculative practice. The notion of a rehearsal might be helpful here. A rehearsal, being in a kind of workshop, playing in a band or a jam session or old man sitting on a porch, or people working together in a factory. There are these various modes of activity. The point of calling it study is to mark the incessant and irreversible intellectuality of these activities is already present. Talking, walking around with other people, and arriving. To arrive is a part of our study, and I would argue also of these very living methodologies we're all invested in. And if fieldwork is a verb, if it is fieldworking, as Sam Nightingale with Bridget Crone and Polly Stanton suggest in their introduction to Fieldwork for Future Ecologies, then we have already begun to verb a field while arriving. These tapes have no tasks to be completed, and surely they are no homework. They are an additional soft scaffolding for everyone's method making. With my collaborator and my friend, sound artist and musician Yoni Uden, we are mixing and jamming, and we lift from the page and read aloud several texts, non-fiction, poetry, and simple readerly and writerly reflection prompts, orbiting around one particular keyword or gesture that's inherently a part of any study, artistic, scholarly, or quotidian. A keyword or a gesture that might occasionally be taken for granted. These concepts, keywords and gestures I took liberty to pick for us appear to be the ones that are just good to revisit or re-sculpt or to reattune to whenever one is in a new field. This first tape introduces the way of reading I would like us to activate and practice while in Kilpisjärvi. This first tape briefly introduces the bodily and political place from which I picked the texts. And this tape also tickles you to think, feel about your body, mind and your needs in the context of field working. The second tape focuses on a gesture of walking, fragments of its politics and attention work that walking may enact. And this tape is recorded for those of us who wish to skip our reading session. You're very welcome to close listen to it, to turn it on and have it as white noise, or not to listen to it at all. The third type reads with berries. For some model of reciprocity, they might encourage. And again, this is for those of us who wish to skip our reading session. And again, there is no need or expectation that you listen to it at all. The fourth tape is drafted for a solo listening and reading moment. The moment with one's curiosity. Curiosity has a non-innocent affect and an orientation device for field working. Tape 5 is a checklist for our departures. It will honor a pause and intervals. Suppose a reading method. Reading is another part of our studying for field working and method making. In the context of living methodologies, I imagine our reading sessions as space times of cooling off after field working and as a part of field working that will surely be invigorating and potentially intense. The three gatherings summon reading as a bodily doing that's, yes, always some work for our vocal cords, for our sight, focusing on the words on the page. But also reading might facilitate an exhale after another day of absorbing, seeking, and for a lack of a better word, actively relating to each other. And while in Kilpisjärvi, I'd like to invite you to read together and read aloud. And once again, let's not take for granted what that means. There is a simple algorithm that I'd like to propose for our reading together and reading aloud. And my simple algorithm emerges between the two books I've been fond of. Both of them are written by an Irish writer, Brian Dillon. Suppose a sentence is one, and the other, affinities. Suppose a sentence is this book that admires sentences that other writers sculpted. Affinities stays with sentences, but also adds images to exact this affect that suppose a sentence detected. Staying in the space that these two books conjure, I propose together with a selection of single doubt sentences and extended quotes from a range of theory, nonfiction, and poetry orbiting around the notions of walking, berries, and curiosity. And first, let's begin each session by just reading the texts once, out loud to each other with no pauses for discussions. And second, let's go back to the texts and each lift from the page a sentence, but also why not a single word that somehow stuck with you against the background of the days we will have had together. Maybe a sentence or a single word with which you might say you feel affinity, or maybe even as Brian Dillon has it, maybe you feel eclipses, those moments of reading when the light changes, some darker lustre takes over. Things, words, seem suddenly obscure even in the simplest sentence, and you find you have to look twice, maybe more than twice. I'd like to encourage all of us to have our notebooks pulled close during our reading sessions. Perhaps there is a sentence or a single word that jumps from the page and into our reading space. And our affinities will contour our soft evening regroundings before saunas or our evening tea. Let's read for affect and for affinities. Or as Brian Dillon writes, maybe for a short sentence after all, a fragment in fact, a simple cry of pain or pleasure, or succession of same of the same cries that's compounded and spoken at the last in extremis, or another sort of beast entirely, whose unmeaning cry is just an overture before the sentence sets in distinguished motion its several parallel clauses, as though it were a creature with at least four legs. Every sentence was once an animal, says Emerson. So slowly but deliberately intent on its progress, so stately in its procession, so lavish in attention to the world it passes through, so exacting in the concentration it demands in return, that what? Here already the sentence swerves, and although you are sure you've caught the sense that shape has begun to elude you, as if the animal in question were squirming or shaking itself loose of your grip, or turning to bite you and then take off, against all entities, into a mist of metaphor, where you must follow, closing the gate of this punctuation mark behind you, and on the other side, everything is both less certain and suddenly swimmingly closer at hand. The sentence stops and looks around and starts comparing itself to the action of a drag, to the light-sucking lens of a camera or the slow apparition of an image, let's say a face, on photographic paper, to festive decorations enchained about church or a storm speeding across the lake towards the place where its writer is sitting. Or the sentence which considers itself very modern has grown tired of such figural adventures, not to speak of the antiquary's accumulation of clauses and subclauses, so that you start to notice certain acts of repetition but also interruption, that gives the sentence a crystalline quality it will always ever after possess, whether it wants to talk about sickness and health, about sunlight outside of Rome and New York afternoon, or the disappearing sun in daytime, even if it's short, even if it's long, even especially if it still aspires to its old elegance, the lofty periods, the plush vocabulary, on which subject, by the way, the sentence has been taking notes, a sample from the archive. Slamgallion, macula, flimmering, glop, exorb, Brumos. Moyle. Ort. Fly Goldin. Claymis. And keeping tabs in case these riches come in useful, because you can say what the sentence will need or want in the future. What expansions or contractions it may endure or enjoy, what knowledge need to master and deploy, whose speech to steal and celebrate, where to be heard the rhythms it needs to leave and let sleep your overly attentive attention, interest in itself in things and parties and obstructions that you no longer recognize and whose names and outlines you will have to entrust to the slippery sentence itself, which it turns out knows more than you do, knows when to seize on and worry the world and when to let go, and it's doing now and goes scattering away from you, its maker, not its keeper, beating the bounds of its invisible domain. For about 25 years, Brian Dillon has been copying sentences into the back pages of whatever notebook he happened to be using mostly for other purposes. The brand, style and quality of these notebooks has changed a few times, but not their dimensions, or not much. They're more or less A5 paperback sized, at home, in the hand or on the desk. Of course, there are sentences elsewhere in these books. Even the briefest, most telegraphic, verbless note is a sentence of sorts. And then there are the quotations and paraphrases from books, descriptions of people and places and things, as well as rough drafts of sentences later to be properly written or not written. But the end of the book sentences are different. Even if some of them come from books I'm reviewing and so on, unconnected to duty or deadlines, the projects per se, they compose a parallel timeline. But of what? I suppose the word is affinity. On the bookshelves behind me, as I'm writing now, there are 45 of those notebooks, black spine interrupted by the occasional red or blue, and even one or two spiral bindings. One day I might track down others which are lost among books and papers and put the whole lot in chronological order. For now, choose a notebook from the shelves at random, and who knows what sliver of time will come with it, or what sentences. I might have saved some sentences for subsequent quotation. They sound self-assured, probing their general points home. What did I think I was seeing in these other sentences, or hearing or hoping to emulate? What did I think I was seeing in these other sentences? It's obvious. An epigrammatic snap. Some truth at odds with received wisdom, a relevance to writing, a degree of portability. As a critic, I can imagine insinuating any of them into an essay or review, maybe not without a little pomp and satisfaction. But the others, how to say, because this must be the word. What I love there. I knew at once that I had no general theory of the sentence, no prescriptive attitude towards the sentence, nor aspired to write its history. If I must, and I felt I must, write about my relationship with sentences, I would have to follow my instinct for the particular. And I'd like to invite us to tickle this very instinct as we read together and out loud, the instinct for the particular. And Brian continues, I found myself frequently using the word affinity and wondered what I meant by it, an attraction for sure to certain works of art or literature, to fragments or details, moods, atmospheres inside them, or that thing Yvonne said during our orientation, or maybe something your neighbor mentioned just before going to sleep, or that one term that we heard or maybe overheard at a lab. Affinity to a sentence. To a sentence, for instance, or an essay, but just as easily to an impression diffusing in the mind that could not be traced back to source. A fascination with this or that artist, writer, musician, filmmaker, designer, or fellow field worker. With a body or a body of work, fascination already finding words with which affinity has affinity. As something like, but unlike critical interest, which has its own excitement but remains too often at the level of knowledge, analysis, conclusions, at worst, the boredom of having opinions, but also the way things, images and ideas sidled up to each other seemed to seduce one another in ways I could not or did not want to explain, so that when I wrote affinity in a piece of critical prose, perhaps I was trying to point elsewhere to a realm of the unthought, unthinkable, unkillable by arguments. Not a question of beauty or quality or taste, other eternal aesthetic values, something fleeting, in fact, affinities don't all or always last. And this is fine in our business of field working and method making. Finding affinities rather than deploying any kind of expertise. Affinities are something that does not leave me alone. What did I mean by affinity? Bright with affinity. As if affinity were a luminous or coruscation. A fizzing halo of possibilities, but also labour and the accident, finding charms and allurements at every step in every sentence. Historically, affinity, a ceremonial as well as spiritual connection, a state of mutual dependence, likeness or proximity as well as alliance. Affinity as liking or attraction, arrived late, deriving from physical and spiritual states, rather than judgment, intention, attitude or desire, though it comes to encompass all of these in complex and sometimes contradictory ways. Once affinity also meant a gathering of like or like-minded people, a group, a gang, a camp. A kind of crush, and like a crush, it tends to mark one out for the moment. How to describe the matter or medium of affinity, the connecting tissue between that thing that I mark out and myself? Here in Annie Dillard, in her essay Scene, a fog that won't burn away drifts and flows across my field of vision. When you see fog move against a backdrop of deep pines, you don't see the fog itself, but clearness floating across the air in dark shroud. So I see only tatters of clearness through a pervading obscurity. I can't distinguish the fog from the overcast sky. I can't be sure if the light is direct or reflected. Everywhere darkness and the presence of the unseen appalls. We estimate, now that only one atom dances alone in every cubic meter of intergalactic space. I blink. I can't or won't decide if affinity is the fog or the shred of clearness. I will repeat this proposition and unpack it a little bit more once we are in Kilpisjärvi and gather to read. And the intention to introduce this way of reading here comes from living an era queer life and being an era queer person who loves an instruction, a content note, and paced repetitions. And usually the more I know about the process of something, the more I feel much more relaxed and inclined to participate. And perhaps some of you might be similar. Oh, and also, I always say in any reading room I might be gathering, there is no expectation for everybody around the desk, on the chairs or sofas in the room in Kilpisjärvi to read out loud, or out loud in conventional sense. One's quiet presence is always as valuable as one's louder one. Choosing Queer Kripli. The way I chose the texts relates to this my intention to introduce the reading method before we actually arrive and meet each other. And I chose the texts and the method of reading Queer Kripli. Queer Krip shortens the offensive term cripple, reclaimed and repoliticized by the diverse transnational community of body minds that do not fulfill an ableist idea of an economically efficient citizen. Creep doesn't stand for a synonym of disability that's redundantly too often associated with pathologized or visible and formally medicalized bodily conditions. Queer creep cares about body minds who live in excess of a colonial modern imperial idea of able-bodied disabled binary. Queer Krip seeks to embrace all systematically and structurally marginalized experiences of sensorial, affective, emotional, writerly and readerly, biochemical and other materially specific disablements. Like mine that are a result of medical mistakes, environmental violence, and often border regimes, or like this one. 450 milligrams of nitrate in the groundwater, 300 in the well, 900 in the drinking water, all per liter, all when the guideline is 50 milligrams of nitrate in the groundwater, in the well, in the drinking water. 1,800 milligrams of chloride in the wells, 600 in the drinking water, all per liter, all when the guidelines are 250 milligrams of chloride in the wells, in the drinking water. Make the settlers drink the Knox water and watch a body attack itself. Acid limber, bitter tongue, bitten off and spat out, thrashing on the wet concrete, dead fish, shallow water. Too many macaws on a clay lick will make it collapse. Clay lick sinks into sea. Clay lick sinks into sea in Rock Flight. A poetry book written by Lebanese-Palestinian writer, editor, art worker and educator Hasib Hourani. Queer Creep. A site of expanded community affiliation and political resistance that figures all the dominant infrastructures, including those of field working and method making, as systemically disempowered positions, potentially disabling. Queer is an orientation away from the normative, from the dominant, elsewhere where anything is possible. Queer Creep perspective is ripe with potential for diversely ethical method making, and it invites everybody to begin making with the fact that one's body-mind is a field. One's body-mind is a battlefield of multiple powers, but it is a field that knows. It is a field of sorts, field working itself tirelessly. While arriving to fieldwork towards some of those otherwise worlds, think, feel about your needs. Needs that change and needs that nobody knows in detail. Think, feel about your needs with your body, mind, and with Johanna Hadva, a badass queer creep writer and artist. Think, feel with a few paragraphs from their recent book, How to Tell When We Will Die, on pain, disability, and doom. It's written towards the screech of extractive capitalism to its much-needed, long-overdue, and motherfucking glorious halt. Not my words, Johanna Hadva's, but I second. To be alive on this earth is to live in the abundance of the body's peculiarities, and to have a body is to be determined by that body's ceaseless needs, and bodies, even at their best, even if they aspire to nothing else, are so delicate and dependent that they can't get by alone. I want to reckon with the twined facts that our bodies are fragile and in need of constant care and support, but that we have built our world as if opposite was true. Who benefits? Who profits from all these lies? The definition of the body that I like the most is that it's anything that needs support. It's a human body that needs food, rest, sleep, shelter, care, other humans. It's a social body that needs to be propelled and maintained by a collective's aim, the tension of many convergences and disagreements coalescing into a whole. It's a body of water that needs a solid ground on which to rest and surge. I like to truncate this definition to make the body, especially the human body, simply a thing that needs. B. because what else would support be but needed? Your body mind, that thing that needs, that thing that also feels, that thing that's field working. What does it need while it's field working? Physically, cognitively, effectively. A peach, a cherry, what pace? A pause, warm water in a flask, a break, or that book in print, prompts in writing, or maybe to speed up? List it. Keep asking. It's okay to need. And we do need to support our field. Because what else would support be but needed?